So first off, thank you, Satchadaya. I knew if I invited Satchadaya to do the intro, because I knew it would be funny and engaging, and it would hopefully make it worth your while just to come to hear that. But he did remind me of a story, and some of you will have met my sister, who was over a couple of years ago working in the festival. And I was telling a story about how rough the area was when I grew up. She said, "It was only rough because you lived there." which there might have been something in that. So anyway, what I'd like you to do is I would like you to move in. Come in, come in.
How many inches?
Oh, 20. It. And I would now like you to look at the people around you. See who's around you. Make eye contact with them. Hold the eye contact. Hold it just for maybe 2, 3, 4, 5 seconds, 6 seconds. And as you hold the eye contact with them, allow yourself to feel your breath. And if for some reason you haven't got eye contact with somebody, just allow your awareness to be inside. Notice how that feels. So notice, is the breath soft? Is it juddery, like going down steps? Is it silky? And so notice how it is to be you this morning. You're alive. The sun's shining. You might think, "Damn, I should have gone to that other workshop." Now, Satchadaya sort of said one of my qualities is courage. I'm also quite robust, so if you get up and walk out, I'll just think she or he has decided the dance workshop was more appealing. So, having looked at somebody else, having connected with yourself, have you noticed any change in how you experience yourself?
More in my belly.
Sorry?
More in your belly.
So, thank you for coming. As usual, I've spent hours worrying about when I'm going to prepare this talk. But in some ways, I think I've spent many years trying to be able to just hope the inspiration comes. There's a few, the title of the talk is "What Would the Buddha Say If He Was Alive Today?" And maybe that's why you've come to the talk, or maybe you came to the talk thinking that I was Sinaketu, and it's something on nonviolent communication. He's in the other dome. But I'm going to try and talk about what I imagine the Buddha would talk about if he was alive today. So if he was alive today, the Buddha probably would have been born into quite a wealthy family. He probably, if he was born in the UK, probably would have gone to Eton. And at Eton, he would have had the finest education that money can buy. So, sure, Eton turns out some buffoons who like riding bicycles, which is a positive quality, and getting stuck on aerial runways at Olympics. But there are also some guys who go to Eton who manage to live from the heart, who have an aspiration for truth, beauty and goodness. So the Buddha would have been one of those. And following his education at Eton, where he would have excelled, he may well have gone to somewhere like Sandhurst Officer Training School, following the tradition of his family of being generals and majors, with an aspiration and a good heartedness to try and bring peace into the world, to try and provide protection, organization and stability to the realm. And his mother and father, well, if you're following the historical Buddhist story, his mother died within the week of him being born, but he was brought up by a stepmother who loved him as if she was her own. So he'd been brought up knowing he was loved, deeply, deeply loved. But he'd also grown up knowing he had a duty that his parents would have instilled in him. A duty to serve, a duty to protect ideals. And his parents, just like your parents, will have wanted the best for him. However, their means were probably much more substantial than your means. And so that probably meant in the winter months, he would have holidayed in the finest ski resorts. And they would have had a chalet, maybe in Wengen, just beneath the Matterhorn. And they would have skied there, and he would have excelled. And in the summer months, they would have maybe holidayed in the Caribbean, sailing, surfing, windsurfing. And again, he would have excelled. And his family would have tried to protect him. But being aware and alive and awake, though he would have had all these worldly pleasures, the best that money can buy, there would have been still this sense that there's something more. There's something more. And a bell would have sounded inside. That would have woken him. And he would have noticed that not everybody has health care. There are sick people. He would have noticed. It wouldn't have been something that worried him. His family had such resources that if he ever became ill, you know, his treatment would have been second to none. Maybe he had a few scrapes and injuries, but he would have been treated by the finest physios, the finest doctors. But he would have noticed. One day, it would have struck him. Others are not as privileged as me. And the healthcare access that they've got to, that they've got access to, is really limited. And being this kind of strange mixture of strength and sensitivity, it would have gone into him, right deep into his heart. And he couldn't sit easy with the fact of his privilege. you know, whether it be in America, if he was born in America, it would have been, you know, Harvard University, but still he would have seen that if some people get ill, their access to healthcare is appalling. And he would have felt that. It's not that he would have sort of felt the, well, thank goodness for me, I've got this healthcare. So that would have stayed as a nagging doubt for him. You know, okay, yeah, I'm all right, but what about these people? Not just people in the UK, where the medical services are stretched, not just people in maybe America who don't have access to healthcare, but people in third world countries who have no access whatsoever, or because of maybe caste, are shunned when they seek healthcare. That would have stayed with him. That would have stayed with him. That would have hurt. And he would have wanted to find a solution to that. And then he would have seen old people. And not like he would just sort of think, oh yeah, they're old, you know, losing their marbles or whatever, you know, doddering, strangely dressed, maybe dirty, maybe smelling of urine. He would have noticed, and he would have let it in, God, into his heart. Wow. And he would know the humility that comes from knowing his privilege and seeing that we get old. If we're lucky, we get old. And within that getting old, some of us have more connection and support than others. And even those who have connection and support still, you know, sometimes lost in the distressing world of dementia, of confusion, of fear, of losing your grip on reality. He would have seen that. And the phrase in the Pali scripture says, the arrogance of youth fell away from him. But he would have had the capacity to feel in his heart the fear, the vulnerability, the confusion, the despair. You know, I find it difficult enough getting old as it is. You know, I sort of look in the mirror and think, God, I'm not as good looking as I used to be. Well, you might not believe that, but it's kind of like, yeah. And it's going to get worse. It's not going to get better. So we lose, you know, the beauty we have of youth. We don't. In fact, when I was young, I didn't even realize that I was, you know, young, vibrant, good looking. Because we compare. There's always somebody better looking than you. Yeah. But as you start to get old, which, if you're lucky, you will, you'll lose that. So the arrogance of youth fell away for him, or would fall away for the Buddha. And then he would see death. He would know that life ends in death. None of us get out of here alive. That's not the Butterfield Festival I'm talking about, by the way. Life. The moment you are born, you're part of the cycle of life. Which includes death. And he would have let that into his heart. And it would have been in his heart, despite having all that he needed, all the privilege, all the magnificence of his skills and his learning and his education, those things would have sat in his heart. And if he'd only seen those three sights, he may have become cynical. What?
Despair.
He may have become despairing. Thank you for the prompt. He may have become despairing, overwhelmed. Yeah. Despairing. What's the purpose? He may have moved towards nihilism and think, there's nothing worth engaging with here. It's all a load of rubbish. I managed to contain myself then. And then, thinking that it's all a waste of time, there's no purpose behind it, he probably would have gone on the most outrageous drugs binge you could imagine. But within that, there may well have been a searching as well. Is there a way out of this? You know, ayahuasca maybe. Or LSD. Or mushrooms. Marijuana. He would have been experimenting. The Buddha, you know, the historical Buddha, was nothing if not thorough. He would have done them all. Yeah? And unfortunately, if you do them all, you blow your mind a bit. And if you want an example of that, just talk with Sachidayan afterwards. So, sorry, brother. So, he'd have kind of taken it to the extreme. And at some point, something would have come in and think, this is not the way. But there would have been maybe that nihilistic, despairing streak. However, if he had only seen the fourth sight, that of the holy man, he would have been cynical. Yeah? Without seeing the other three sights, we just see the holy man, we think, what a waster. Oh, what a waster. This guy with this round his neck. Yeah, up his own bottom. Sometimes that's true. I confess. So, but he saw the four sights, the Buddha in the modern day, and he pursued the goal of, well, what is the meaning of life? What is there a way out of this suffering, this cycle? And a bell would have gone off in his head. And he says, I must find others who can teach me. And because of his great education, where he studied, you know, the philosophical traditions, he would have understood his, you know, Schopenhauer, he'd have read Nietzsche, Wittgenstein, Kierkegaard. I can hardly even say these guys' names, never mind understand what they're saying, but he'd have read them and he would have understood them. And let's move the story forward. So he awakens. He awakens to see that the idea of a separate self is toxic. The idea of a separate self is toxic. Probably the most toxic idea on the planet. That I exist in isolation. So he woke up. I like the word Buddha means awake. So he woke up. And I don't know whether you've ever had those dreams where you wake up in the morning and you think, oh, thank God, that was a dream, yeah? Have you had it? You had those? And sometimes, even though you've woken up from that dream, you still sort of think, did it really happen? Yeah? I remember one time I had this dream about this order member who I admire greatly, an order member called Vasantra, and I had this dream where he was slashed across the face with a razor. And I woke up and sort of, poor. I didn't know what the dream meant, and I reflected on, but next time I saw him, I was kind of, I couldn't, you know, I kept checking. The dream was kind of deep. It was something deep. But I was kind of like, no, it wasn't. It was a dream. I did one time wake up one morning and sort of think, oh, that was a terrible dream. And then realized that it wasn't. Which was the night I was dressed in a tutu and a black top and a skimpy top. And I managed to crash a van in the French Alps and have to hitch home through the snow. And I woke up the following morning and I thought that was a terrible dream. And it wasn't. It was true. But that's another story. Anyway, but it's not about me. Much as I tend to slip that way just due to my general narcissism. But yes, back to the Buddha. The Buddha's conditioning was such that he would have known his place in the world. One of the blessings of kind of our social conditioning is that no matter what your social conditioning, there are shadow sides to it. But one of the blessings I see with people who have grown up with wealth and whose parents were bright, loving and attentive is there's a confidence and a security about their place in the world. And people who may be quite talented, who've grown up in a working class condition, there is always this kind of sense of insecurity and trying to prove oneself. You know, and it's an embarrassment that I carry around with me. Yeah. And so the Buddha, he awakens to reality. And what does he teach in the modern day? He teaches that there is suffering. There's a cause of suffering. And there's a way out of it. But you see, looking round, one of the great things about the Buddha, when he sat in an assembly of people, he was just so grounded in himself that he could pick up what was going on with people. And he would try and teach appropriately so as the people within that group would kind of go, wow. And the level of insight that he would share. So my mind reading capacities are really poor. So I kind of ramble around, so forgive me for that. But what would he say? The conditions with the modern world, I did want to kind of research how many people are alive at the time of the Buddha. I imagine it was in the millions. Maybe probably around 10 million throughout the whole world. And now we're living on a planet of approaching 7.5 billion. But he would really be teaching the same thing. However, the emphasis might be not so much on purity, which probably comes from speaking within the Hindu tradition, which he was born into. But nowadays he would speak, if he was speaking with scientists, he would speak the words maybe of Einstein. We need to free ourselves from the prison, the circle of a sense of self. It's not quite the quote of Einstein, but it's not far off. He also says that we imprison ourselves in our circle of concern, and we need to widen consistently that circle of concern to embrace all of humanity, all of life. He also said, the greatest wisdom is awe. to feel awe. So one of the things that we don't have in the modern world is this sense of feeling awe. And I think I'll read a poem. Be here now. Be here. No need to move. You are all that's needed. Leave wealth to those who have nothing else. Listen. The wind's dropped. The stars overflow above your head. These moments have taken billions of years to grow. Don't drop them now. Here, take the key. It's all yours. So he would have kind of wanted to try and communicate the sense of immense beauty just in being. And he would have also said that you need to breathe. You need to be in touch with the breath. And he taught, supposedly he was doing the mindfulness of breathing when he awoken. And modern neuroscience, and he would have spoken to modern neuroscientists, tell us that the breath is one of the most vital ways of calming our system. When we're triggered into difficult mental states, he'd have said, stop. Breathe out slowly through the nose. Calm your system. If you're angry, you're not going to be able to see the truth of things. So feel. Feel the sensations in your body. Know that if you act from an unskillful mind, you will create suffering for yourself and others. Know that if you can open to the heart's vulnerability, a bell will go off inside you that you will awaken to the idea that operating from a pure mind, happiness follows. Your happiness is within your hands. He probably would have said, do not be afraid of sadness and pain. There's a sutta where he talks about dealing with fear. And I imagine he would say the same about dealing with sadness and despair, and that is to feel it, to breathe it, but not to sink so deep into it that you cannot keep perspective. And so he may well have quoted the poem by Naomi Shabu Nye, Kindness. Before you know what kindness really is, you must lose things. Feel the future dissolve in a moment, like salt in a weakened broth. What you held in your hand, what you counted and carefully saved, all this must go. so you know the landscape between the regions of kindness. How you ride and ride, fearing the bus will never stop. The passengers eating maize and chicken will stare out the window forever. Before you know the tender gravity of kindness, you must travel where the Indian in the white poncho lies dead by the side of the road. You must see how this could be you. How he too was someone who journeyed through the night with plans and the simple breath that kept him alive. Before you know kindness as the deepest thing inside, you must know sorrow as the other deepest thing. You must wake up to sorrow, speak to it, till your voice catches the thread of all sorrows and you see the size of the cloth. Then, it's only kindness that makes sense anymore. Only kindness that wakes you up and sends you out into the day, ties your laces, sends you out into the day to mail letters and purchase bread. Only kindness which raises its head from the crowd of the world to say, "It is I that you have been looking for," and then goes with you everywhere like a shadow or a friend. So he would have maybe spoken, and within that poem, as I recited it then, there are the sights, the Indian dead by the side of the road. We need to see the sights. We need to look in the mirror and know that we too will die. And from that sadness, open to this precious opportunity that we have as a human being. The precious opportunity to make a difference. This is Einstein again. The only life worth living is a life for others. Now you might sort of think, oh, I do live my life for others. But I think some of us need to deepen the sense of ourself. Become more robust emotionally, work with our minds more skillfully. Meet ourselves with kindness. Most of us have got trauma. And if you've got trauma, it manifests quite often in feeling overwhelmed. Getting out into nature. The Buddha spent his life outdoors, walking. He also kept his life simple. The simple life, and that's the theme of this year, the simple life is not a life that's got rid of all the possessions. The simple life is a life headed in one direction. The one direction, I think, is to awaken. Kind of be curious about who you are. Know that you are a mystery to yourself. So meet all your flawed bits with as much patience, kindness, and tenderness as you can. When you notice the repetitive voice saying, "You've done that again, Jairaj, you're such an idiot," you kind of treat yourself like a very patient psychiatric nurse of many years experience and sort of say, "Oh, you messed up again, didn't you? Yeah. Oh, you poor thing. Yeah. Oh." So you need to be able to do that to yourself. Because the idea of perfection is one of the pollutants that the Buddha might address. The idea that we have to be perfect. I think one thing that the Buddha would do is he was very good at irony. And he would have no end of things to be ironic about. You know, looking adverts. You know, God, man, advertising. How toxic is the world of advertising? If you're in advertising, please forgive me. but hopefully we'll find you a job at Butterfield. I can't promise you much money, if any money, but we'll feed you. So, you know, advertising works on the basis of you're inadequate. But if you buy this, or get this, or this retirement plan, or kind of have this kind of hair gel, life's going to be okay. Well, how stupid is that? And we kind of, now it's not like it just happens once a day. It happens, I think it's the average person sees 3,000 ads a day. Yeah? One of the things the Buddha would say is, guard the gates of the senses. Guard the gates of the senses. That's one of the most important teachings today. You know, on this field, I keep having to tell myself, guard the gates of the senses. I'm sort of so excitable. I wander around. Yeah, and part of that's, who likes me around here? Who's going to say something nice to me? And it's kind of like, Jairaja, that is not going to conduce to contentment. Contentment is the greatest wealth. Do you realise you come to the Butterfield Festival? Sure, the ticket's £145 and a bargain, I might say. But you're going to leave with contentment. You are leaving more wealthy than you arrived. How good is that? So, contentment, the greatest wealth. So where does contentment come from? There must be a store around here that sells it. Contentment comes from tuning into yourself and honesty with yourself, and then looking maybe for the richness that is within. Contentment also comes, I guess, from seeing how much we have been given to. You probably know that Rumi poem better than I do, which is, look at the sun who is given to the earth, who never says, you owe me. What kind of beauty comes from that? What kind of love is that? So we are surrounded by so much. We are surrounded by so much, but most of us, or me, at times, can be like a man in a freshwater river, thirsty. Yeah. Khalil Gibran, the thirst that is not satisfied when the well is full is not a thirst that can be satisfied. And in that, I think he's talking about addiction. So the Buddha had this great capacity. Whoever he met, he was present with. And spoke to them in their language. So if he met farmers, he would talk about farming and teach them. Not about farming, but about cultivating the mind. I love the story about the horse trainer. Do you know the story about the horse trainer? So he meets the horse trainer, and the horse trainer is kind of a bit dismissive of this guy wandering. He says, well, what do you do? And he says, well, I train horses. The Buddha says, I train human beings. And he says, well, are there ever any human beings you can't train? And he said, well, what's it like for you? How do you train horses? And he says, well, some horses need just kindness. Some horses need firmness. Some need a mix of both. And the guy says, well, is that the same with your disciples? And he said, yes. Some of them need just kindness. Some of them need firmness. And some of them need a mix of both. And then he says, this guy says to the Buddha, is there ever any horses, is there ever any disciples you can't train? And the Buddha says, well, is there ever any horses you can't train? And he says, yes. He said, what do you do with them? He says, we have to kill them. Otherwise, they have a very negative effect on all the other horses. And then he says, so the Buddha says, well, it's the same with us. And he says, what, you kill them? And he says, no, we exclude them from the spiritual community. And for them, that is a death. So there's certain kind of toxicity that people can bring to the spiritual community that is not helpful. One of the things that the Buddha would address nowadays would be the idea of abuse. Yeah? We're kind of so het up on this idea of who are the victims? we need to rescue them, and we need to persecute the bad guys. The whole language of abuse. Yeah? He probably would have said something like, they abused me, they beat me, they robbed me, they said nasty things about me on Facebook. Those who envelop themselves in such thoughts do not still their hatred. They abused me, they beat me, they robbed me, they humiliated me on Facebook. Those who do not wrap themselves in such thoughts still their hatred. So what we do with our minds is key. But you would have spoken to scientists, physicists, materialists, and you would have helped them find a sense of mystery and curiosity within that. When I was actually preparing for this talk, I read a lot of, not just the neuroscience stuff, but I was reading a lot of physics, quantum physics. And I really enjoyed it, but I cannot, kind of for the life of me, explain it in such a way that would make sense in a talk. But believe me, the universe is very mysterious. The universe is not what you imagine. Did somebody say something? So the eye outside. Yeah. So, but one way of looking at the world is that we are parts of a whole. Just like my hand is part of the whole of this body, actually this mind, and when I look at this mind and see the strange nature of this mind, I kind of know it's not mine. Yeah? If it was mine, it would do as I told it, but then who would be doing the telling of it? It doesn't do what I tell it. You know, I sit down to meditate, follow the breath. It doesn't do that. It drifts off. Who I am is a mystery. So being curious about myself, meeting myself with kindness and patience, meeting myself with tenderness and forgiveness, having the capacity to experience emotion fully. The Buddha probably would have emphasized the arts of ways of getting out of our two conceptual minds. The thinking mind. He would have sort of said, God, the thinking mind is crazy. He would have stressed, feel the raw sensation in your body. Be attentive to any images that arise. Feel the feelings as they are. And then, using your thinking to discriminate between what leads to my welfare and the welfare of others, and what leads to the welfare and suffering, or what leads to suffering. So that distinction, if we act with a good mind, a pure heart, happiness follows. We all want happiness. Not the kind of superficial pleasure type thing, but we all want to be engaged with significance and meaning. Another poem's come to mind. Let's see if I can... You do not need to be good. You do not need to walk for hundreds of miles on your knees through the desert. You only need to let the soft animal of your body love what it loves. Tell me about your despair, and I will tell you mine. Meanwhile, the sun and the clear pebbles of the rain are moving across the landscapes, across the prairies and the deep trees, the mountains and the rivers. Meanwhile, high in the clear blue air, the wild geese are heading home again. Wherever you are, no matter how lonely, the world offers itself to your imagination. Calls to you like the wild geese, harsh and exciting, announcing your place in the family of things. So I wanted to finish with a sutta, the Mangala Sutta, which I think is very profound. And I also wanted to finish with a poem. And then I think we've probably got some time for Q&A, if that's kind of an acceptable thing in a talk. Thus have I heard. So one time, so the Buddha is sitting in the Jeta Grove. And one of the things the Buddha used to do was he used to teach not just human beings. He would teach the devas, the angels, the spirits, the tree spirits. They would all come to him. And this spirit comes to the Buddha and says, "Hey Buddha, how do I know things are going to go well for me? How can I sort them out?" So there was the idea of, the spirit seems to have the idea of luck. What brings good luck? The Buddha says to him, in his skillful way, "Many deities," oh, this is the deva, "many deities and humans longing for well-being have pondered upon blessings or have pondered upon what is auspicious. Tell us, what is the most auspicious sign of all?" Then the Buddha says, "Not associating with fools. Associating with the wise. Honouring those worthy of honour. This is the most auspicious sign. Or this is the greatest blessing. Residing in a suitable location. Good deeds performed in the past. Setting oneself in the right direction. This is the greatest blessing. Great learning and craft, well trained and disciplined in mind, with every utterance well spoken. This is the greatest blessing. Support of mother and father, the care and welfare of partner and children, engaging in unconflicted livelihood. This is the greatest blessing. Selfless giving and living by the truth, looking after relatives and friends, and blameless actions. This is the greatest blessing. Ceasing and restraining from evil, abstinence from intoxicants like Facebook and the Guardian sports pages. I hadn't noticed that bit before. Diligence concerning all phenomena. This is the greatest blessing. Reverence and humility, contentment and gratitude, listening to the truth when it's spoken. This is the greatest blessing. Patience and discipline. Again, discipline. The seeking of recluses. Timely discussion of the truth. So talking about things that matter, that are meaningful. Not about football. I hadn't noticed that bit before either. Austerity. Or simplicity and contentment of mind and body. Insight into the noble truths, the realization of awakening. This is the greatest blessing. With a mind unshaken when touched by worldly conditions, sorrowless, stainless, and secure. This is the greatest blessing. Those who have fulfilled all these are everywhere, invincible. And they find well-being everywhere. This, to them, is the greatest blessing. So it's such, you know, it's so relevant to today. The teaching of the Buddha, ethical practice, community, friendship. Not getting caught up in such ideas as blame. Sure, every one of us could build a mountain of grievance against the world, against others, against our partner. Yeah? And if you do that, suffering will follow, like the wheels follow the hoof of the ox. Discipline of the mind. I was at a neuroscience conference a while back, and he said, every day you brush your teeth, you take care of your dental hygiene. He said, we don't give any thought to mental hygiene. Every day you should be sitting still, even if it's 5 minutes, tuning into yourself. If you can't sit still for 5 minutes, try and go outside and experience some wonderment at the trees, at the wind, at the stars. In a Butterfield festival, wonderment is absolutely everywhere. Yeah? The kids, the creativity, the workshops, this blessing that we are part of. May it go out to benefit all beings. Because we are part of a whole. So look after your part. Take care of those parts around you, your parts of the nexus. We can transform the world. It will not be transformed through power struggle. Leave wealth and power struggle to those who have nothing else. When they see the richness of our contentment, when they see the richness of the love and open heart that we can develop through patience, diligence, hard work and friendship, create community. Look in wonderment on other human beings. Look in wonderment in the mirror in the morning. May you be well and happy. Thank you.